I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology. There was nobody who understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly biotechnology podcast that's not just about biotechnology, providing information to help you change hearts and minds, moving innovations to application with communication.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things it can do for people and the planet. I'm Kevin Fulda, and I will not be talking to you today. Instead, I'm turning the microphone over to Dr. Allison Van Enenem. Now, Dr. Allison Van Enenem has been a guest on the podcast at least four times now. She's also been a leading voice in biotechnology and biotechnology education, with efforts such as her very prominent role in the documentary Food Evolution. She's also been featured on many different podcasts, does a lot of writing, and a lot of training in this particular area. She talked to a number of experts about several different topics that I won't give away the punchline. But it is really a very special episode. And you think back to TV, at least in the 70s, when they would talk about a very special episode, meant it was something like really socially poignant, like
today on a very special episode of Happy Days, Potsy and Ralph Malf catch Joni doing downers. They tell the Fonz, and his relationship with Mr. and Mrs. C may change forever. Starring Tom Bosley and Marion Ross.
Totally remember when they used to do that. But it is a special episode. And hope you really enjoy it. So thank you as always for listening. And we'll talk to you again soon.
This is Allison Van Enenem, and I'm at the University of California, and we're doing a special podcast here today in my office with three visiting scientists from around the globe. They're here for the Institute of Food Agricultural Literacy event at Davis, where we'll be talking about the importance of scientific communication, and I thought I would take advantage of that fact to interview these three scientists and talk a little bit about the work they do and their interests in agriculture. And so the first guest I'm going to interview is a pleasure to meet again, Emma Nalugima from Uganda, who was actually associated with Food Evolution. She's a veterinarian that you see in the show, if you've seen that movie. But she's a farmer in Uganda, and so welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you, Alison. And it's a great pleasure to be here with you.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, Emma.
Now, I practice integrated farming on a small scale and on just 1 acre. And in this 1 acre, I keep pigs, cattle, fish, chickens, and I grow vegetables as well, plus plantain.
Wow. That's a lot of animals on 1 acre. How do you do that?
What I do is that, that's why I say I integrate everything. So one thing that comes from, like, take for example, the manure that comes from the pigs helps me feed my chickens and my fish. And then afterwards, I use the rest of the dung to put in my plantain, and I grow very healthy plantain. And then the water that comes from the fish still helps me irrigate the plantain and the vegetables.
Wow. Okay. And so this 1 acre is irrigated or rain-fed, or how do you get your water for the facility?
Actually, where I stay, where I come from, or where the farm is, we are always not having rain. where the rest of the country is having rain, we don't have the rain. So we get our water from the ground, and then that's why I plug out with the water from the fish and also with the urine from the animals. So I use the urine from the animals, I dilute it with water from the fish. Then I have two things, I have water and I'll have manure.
And that provides you nitrogen.
Yeah, that's so it provides me nitrogen, it will provide me water.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, because if I use the urine, it also helps me repel pests that actually affect many of the, affect the planting. So in a way, as I'm using, playing around with animal waste, I have water, I have manure, I have repellents for certain types of pests.
Okay.
Like nematodes.
So it all works together then.
Yes.
So you practice organic agriculture, I believe.
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh. So tell me how this all works together in your organic system.
Now, first of all, when I feed the pigs, I get whatever comes out of the pigs, like the pig dung, is what I will use. So this is what I do. I get the pig dung, leave it out for about 6 to 8 hours, and then afterwards, while I do that, I'm attracting flies because pig dung is a little bit smelly, but a nice smell.
If you say so.
I actually tell people that the smell of pig dung is like the biggest currency in my country is a 50,000 shilling note. So the smell of a pig dung is like the smell of a 50,000.
Ah, so pig dung smells like money to you. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah, it
okay.
does. So that smell attracts the flies, and the flies lay eggs on, when they come, they lay eggs on the pig dung. And then then I play with the life cycle of a housefly. So after 4 to 5 days, I cover the dung. After 6 to 8 hours, I'll cover it for 4 to 5 days. And when I open it, I have nice, juicy maggots. And then
you are kind of a science nerd, right? Like, most people don't think maggots are really nice and juicy, but in your brain, they are, yes.
So, and then they feed them to the chickens.
Wow.
So, I don't spend money on my chickens because they'll help me. Now, my chickens do two things. They'll feed on the maggots, but also they'll help me degrade the dung very fast. So instead of I waiting for one whole month for the dung to degrade, it takes me about a week or two. So then, and then I'll introduce earthworms in the pig dung after it has been eaten by the chickens. So when I introduce the earthworms, these earthworms multiply, and then I will still use these earthworms to feed on the chickens and my fish. So I also feed the maggots on my fish as well. So it helps me cut down on the cost I would have done if I was buying food, especially protein. And in my country, we compete with the animal protein we use in animal feed is silverfish, which humans use as well. So I kind of cut down on the competition protein. And also on the cost, because it's quite costly. And then, meanwhile, you very well know that whenever a living animal eats and drinks, it will excrete. So I also tap on the excreta of the earthworms. So, and that excreta is called vermiliquid, which is very rich and very nutritious also.
We're talking worm poo here, am I correct? Okay, just wanted to clarify that.
Worm poo, worm urine. So
I didn't know worms weed, but okay.
So, and then I will tap that urine and I will use it again as a fertilizer for my planting and vegetables. And it also acts as a pesticide, so like it will get rid of all aphids and all funny pests. So this helps me, I don't have to spend on pesticide. And it also coats on the roots of the plantain so that things like nematodes don't eat on the roots of the plantain. So all this I do in this 1 little acre farm.
Wow.
Yes.
And you feed your family? You have family?
Oh, yes. I have two girls, twins, and a boy, and my husband. And, of course, in Africa, you can't, when family is not, we're not like Americans where it's just you and your kids and your husband. We have other relatives.
Extended family.
Yeah, extended family. So we have quite many people who stay with us, and we are able to feed, and I'm able to take my kids to school using this 1 acre. I'm able to live a relatively comfortable life.
And so where did you get your education and knowledge about how to make this 1 acre work for you?
Surprisingly, I did all this out of luck, because I started farming when I used to keep pigs before I got married, and before, but then when I got married, I gave birth to premature twins. So I stopped working as a vet.
How premature were they?
They were 7 months.
Okay.
So
32 weeks or so.
Yeah. 32 weeks. So I stayed home. I needed to stay home to look after them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then being a vet, being a vet, you're always up and about. So I missed being the animal part.
Twins didn't keep you busy?
They did, but there was, like I said, in Africa, when you give birth, that's when, earlier we're only two in our home, but then I gave birth and you have extra hands because they are primers, you need to wash, you need to do what. We don't have a lot of machinery, so a lot of other people had to come on board, so you need to feed them, and I'm not working anymore, I'm only depending on my husband, so there was a lot to do, so I decided to farm, and that's how everything came. And I started with, already I had pigs, and then I decided to grow plantain, and then I decided to grow vegetables, but all these things I was doing for my table, so that I have food on my table. But because I had plenty of time on me, I looked after them well, and then there were more than I needed to eat, so I started selling them.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so did you learn a lot of this when you said you're a vet, so yeah. You went to university to get a vet?
Yes, I went to university to get a vet degree, but sometimes, all this is just about animals. But then as you're looking out and looking at these things, take, for example, how I started playing around with the dung for the chickens, because I used to look at these chickens, like whenever I used to throw the pig poo somewhere in the corner, I see these chickens run there, and I'm like, okay, what are they looking for? And then I looked and looked, and then I saw them, they're looking for maggots. I'm like, okay, how, and earthworms and whatever. So I'm like, what if I made this more?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting now. I make as many, like I can make 15, 20 kilos of maggots out of just a few kilos of dung.
You're the maggot whisperer. Wow, that's a great story. And so you're here to speak about your farm?
Yes, I'm here to speak about my farm. I think the topic is about some sustainability. So maybe a few people have heard my story, so that maybe it's one way to keep a farm sustainable and to do farming.
And so what do you see as the key to sustainability?
There's no one key. There's no one silver bullet to this. It's about making sure that you use different technologies to do this. Because while I'm doing all this, maybe I forgot to talk about now. These are the different technologies. There's vermiculture. Then I also have hydroponics, because I feed my pigs and my cows on hydroponics. Then there's also, I do aquaponics. So it's about playing around with different technologies available.
And were you a science kind of geek growing up, or what got you interested in pursuing this?
No, I wasn't. I was just...
Why did you pursue veterinary science?
I actually didn't know that I loved animals long way before, but as normally when you get married, there's something they do, the memory lane.
Uh-huh.
So, and it's only then that I saw that, oh my God, they started showing pictures of me since I was young, like with animals. And I'm like, oh, I loved animals. So I didn't know that I loved them that much, but I just found myself, when I missed my points, I missed points to go to do medicine. So the next degree available was vet medicine, but I don't regret it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so Uganda's a bit different to the United States.
Yeah, it is.
When you come to visit, what's like the thing that most sticks out in your mind that's like, wow, that's really different?
In terms of, because they're different things now. My first experience when I came to the US, is, yeah, I know, I knew there's no matoke or banana or plantain, but then I didn't expect so much bread.
So much bread, okay. So bread's not a big part of the diet?
Yeah, but then it was too much. We used to cooking food all the time. So then they served us. They said, oh, guys, it was still after conference. And they're like, okay, guys, don't leave. We're serving lunch. So I was looking forward to this buffet lunch. And to my surprise, everything was bread.
That's really interesting. So you mentioned matoke, which yeah. is a type of banana, yes. as I understand it. And in Uganda, that's got a disease issue. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Now, matoke is the staple food of not the whole of Uganda, but now it has actually spread to the whole of Uganda. So like wheat or bread is here. Uh-huh. So that is what matoke is in Uganda, especially where I come from in the central part of Uganda. So it is a big issue, and everyone, if you don't eat, like, if you came to visit me and I don't serve you matoke, then, oh my God.
That would be really rude.
Yeah. Yeah. You would count me as a very poor person. How do you come to my place and I don't serve you matoke? So it's something that we have to keep. It still comes again with culture and all that. So now it has been affected by banana bacteria wilt. So many people whose livelihood depends on that actually are having issues, and they are literally dying with their plants, because this is what puts food on their table. This is what takes the kids to school when they sell them matoke. So in the event that they've been affected by banana bacteria wilt, then they're going to have issues with their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you have matoke on your 1 acre?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. That's the one. That's what I call plantain, because I imagine not everyone
understands. Plantain, okay.
It's not really plant, but that's what anyone would... when I talk about plantain, then they would understand. Yeah, but it falls in that species of plantains.
Okay. So also in my office here, I have another person from Uganda, Nasib Magwanya. I think I say that correctly. And perhaps you can talk a little bit about what you do, Nasib, in Uganda.
Thank you, Alison. My name is Nasib Magwanya. I work as the outreach officer for Uganda Biosciences Information Center, which is a communication hub for the National Agricultural Research Organization. And speaking about matoke, my organization does much of the research around major crops like matoke, cassava, maize, among other crops. So I spend most of my time communicating about our research to smallholder farmers and how it can benefit them depending on the challenges they're facing.
And so are you kind of like the, I guess, the United States Department of Agriculture research arm? Is that kind of the equivalent organization in Uganda? Are you state financed?
Correct.
Yeah.
So most of our funding is from taxpayers' money, Ugandan
okay.
taxpayers' money. And we are mandated to do basically research around major crops. And ultimately, that research is meant to make Ugandans have more food on their table and also to sell a little bit of what, you know, remains.
To get some income.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And is food security an issue in Uganda?
Oh, yes. Food security is a big issue. And looking at what's happening globally, you know, from climate change, declining soil fertility, these are problems that are also affecting farmers in Uganda, and definitely they're having an impact on how food secure
mm-hmm.
they can be.
And what's your background? Where did you grow up and what did you study?
Oh, cool. So I grew up in a little town, like 1 hour away from the capital, which is Kampala. And I attended a normal primary school. We call them primary schools, mm-hmm. elementary. I didn't, you know, aspire to be a scientist. I didn't know what I wanted to be. But my background is agriculture science, and I specialized in agriculture extension and education. And for the last 4 to 5 years, I've spent most of my time talking about ag biotech and how it's relevant to Uganda. Yeah, that's what I've been doing most
so
of the time.
No wonder we get along well, because yeah, agricultural extension is what I do too.
Cool.
And so with regards to ag biotech, so talk a little bit about the banana, the matoki, that is developed to be resistant to the bacterial wilt that we were talking about earlier with Emma.
Oh, cool. So as Emma said, a huge population in Uganda depends on matoke, as how Americans are having lots of bread in their diet. Actually, just remembered when she was talking about matoke, when I went to say bye to my mom while coming to the U.S., I found her when she had prepared a small meal of matoke, and guess what else was in that meal? Nothing. Other than, you know, and then I asked her, you know, your meal is not balanced, you know, where are the proteins here, where are the vegetables? And she told me, no, this is fine for me. So it's interesting when you come to conferences in America and elsewhere in the world and you tell people that there are people who are depending on eating one meal a day or like a specific type of food. And if that food has only one nutrient, that means that person is only getting that nutrient. So when you hear of technologies like biotech, which can, you know, add in more nutrients so that if someone eats matoke only, they can have proteins, they can have vitamins. It's not luxurious. There are people who are only eating one type of food. But to go back to your question of how my organization is trying to address this problem, definitely there's a lot of ways how this challenge of banana bacterial wilt has been addressed, starting from conventional technologies to upstream tools of science. And what we are seeing so far, the best tools that are helping to save the matoke from this disaster of wilt have been tools of biotech. So there's a good place for this tool to address challenges like banana bacterial wilt, making matoke more nutritious. And these tools should be given a chance so that more people depending on these foods can have access.
And these, but the bacterial wilt resistant bananas have been developed by Ugandan scientists for Uganda?
Oh, correct.
Yeah. And so what is the hold up to get them to the farmers if you've got, I think you have resistant bananas or matoke. So what's the hold up?
So the hold up right now is the policy environment. Uganda ratified the Cartagena Protocol on biotech and biosafety, which requires us to have a law in place so that farmers and consumers can have access to products of biotech. And we don't have that law. It's still in parliament being debated. And the challenge has been that this global ant biotech conversation has gone down to the developing world, and it's affecting how quick policies that would allow technologies like biotech to reach farmers get to the people who need them most. So the biggest challenge right now is having an enabling policy environment, which means having a legislation that would allow farmers and consumers have access to these banana resistant to wield.
So I thought around Christmas time there was some news that suggested there was going to be a biosafety law in place. So has something happened since then that is blocking it?
Oh, yes. Oh, so what is happening currently, we were excited when Parliament passed the bill. So the bill was passed, and then it was waiting for the president to ascend. Like, how, I don't know how it happens to in America, but when bills, you know, pass Parliament, the president signs, and then it's a law. But what happened, as we were excited that Parliament has passed the bill, the president didn't sign the bill and pushed it back to Parliament for revision. And much of this was as a result of the antibiotic activism. You would see that the president's the president not signing was an influence of activists, making it seem there was something wrong with this technology. And so we are now at that point where we are waiting for Parliament to look into the president's concerns, which were not really based on good science, but rather misinformation and a lot of, you know.
So the kind of the fear-mongering that we have here in the first world. And so are the activists that are doing this, are they coming from, where are they coming from?
That's a good question. So it's a mix of global influence, because much of what happens in the developing world is that most non-governmental NGOs are funded from organizations from abroad, and you would not explicitly find them saying we are anti-GMO, but they would disguise under being for farmer rights, to save seed. And what that means actually is them trying to oppose any technology that they conceive as trying to take away, you know, farmer rights. And so that's how they've managed to touch the feelings of people. They make it seem like newer technologies are dominated by corporations. And so if they're given a ground in places like Uganda, smallholder farmers are going to lose their rights. So it's majorly local activists that work in close associations with, and, you know, biotech movements abroad.
And so that corporate narrative doesn't really seem to fit with the organization you work for, which is the government researchers developing solutions for the farmers in Uganda. And so when if these trees were ever to become available, what would be your distribution plan? Is it to give these trees to the farmers, or how would that work if you could allow the technology to be used?
That's a good question. And as you said, the good news about what is happening in Uganda, that the organization doing research around biotech is a government agency. And what that means, if the varieties or the technology is ready to roll out, the same rules of the game that have been applying to other previous technologies, because we are not starting with GMOs only, we've been rolling out conventional varieties. And if small-scale farmers have been getting them through other government entities, so we are the research entity, and then there's the extension entity of the government. So meaning the same rules that have been governing previously around distribution will be the same rules that are going to apply when the GM technologies and the products of GM are ready.
So
nothing new is going to happen. That,
right,
because this, you know, because we've researched this using biotech, there should be different rules of distribution. No, it's going to be the same rules.
And so, are you hopeful that this kind of impasse can be resolved?
Yeah, I'm quite optimistic. that it will be resolved, but it's quite frustrating seeing the potential of this technology and how much it can help with some of the major problems facing farmers, and it cannot get to the end users that fast because of, you know, a few vocal activists who are not actually farmers, but, you know, well-fed people both in the devolved and developing world trying to, you know, make decisions for those who need the technology most. That's someone who spends most of my time talking to farmers. I would tell you that every time you talk to a farmer out there, when they hear you're from a research institute, they will tell you, I've had this problem with my matoke, it wilts. I've had this problem with my cassava, it, you know, gets rotten and I can't even feed it to animals. Do you have a variety that can address this problem? So no farmer would be like, do you have a GMO variety? Do you have a conventional variety? A farmer would be very practical to ask for a solution. And it's upon you, who is coming from the research institution, to look at the various options you have and say, well, depending on what I've had, looks like your matoke is having this problem, and this is so far the best variety we have. So it's quite sad that, you know, the folks out there who are anti-GMO seem to speak on behalf of farmers, but when you get to interact with farmers, they're not even thinking about a GMO option, but rather a solution you have given the challenge they're facing at the time.
Right. Yep. I hear what you're saying, and I think we'll just take a brief break now, and when we'll come back, we'll speak to our third scientist who's in the office here.
Hey everyone, this is Nick Syke from No Ideas Media. If you listen to this podcast, you're probably an awesome person who's probably found themselves in a debate or two about the validity of genetic engineering and its use in food production. You may have even noticed the same problem I've been picking up on. There's lots of good information out there about genetic engineering, but very few people who need to see it are exposed to it. Well, I'm making videos that lay people like myself can actually understand and digest. I'm a filmmaker, so this is my contribution to science communication. They are the perfect thing to post on the wall of that friend you have. You know, that person who just can't seem to grasp the awesomeness of GE crops, who maybe gets hung up on things like chemicals or Monsanto or whatever. The videos I make cover a wide variety of topics, and you can watch them by searching No Ideas Media, remember that's No as in knowledge, on Facebook or YouTube. The videos will likely cover what you already know, but the point is, we gotta share them with people who don't know. The mission at No Ideas Media is to be pragmatic, not dramatic. So help us spread the right information about genetic engineering. Thanks a lot.
This is Alison Van Inenum at the University of California, and we're going to continue the discussion here with three scientists who are at UC Davis for the Institute of Food Agriculture Literacy program on scientific communication. And my next scientist is Marlene Ortez Brocal. Did I do a good job with that?
Yes, it's fine. You're fine.
And tell us about yourself, Marlene.
Well, I recently got my degree and my PhD. I was working on a project which was supposed to engineer rice in order to make it a nitrogen fixing plant.
Ooh.
So, well, luckily that's over for me because it was a long way and it was really interesting. And right now I decided that I wanted to take a different path, and instead of continue with research in academia, I wanted to get into the regulatory world around plants and agriculture in my country. And I recently got a job at the Mexican Seed Association, and I'm going to be in charge of communication and in charge of molding the regulatory environment around the seed industry there in Mexico.
So being in the lab wasn't frustrating enough. You've decided to go into science communication and regulations.
Yes, yes. Well, I did it because I used to be one of those scientists who were only behind the lab walls, and I never knew all the other things that happened after somebody did something in the lab or developed something in the lab. And I actually came to know about all this when I came across the Cornell Alliance for Science, and that's where I knew that all the challenges out there for people to know about facts and all the science illiteracy that we have out there. Especially in Mexico, we have a lot of issues around these topics, and normally people who are not who do not have the knowledge, or who are not who do not have the knowledge around this, are the people who make the decisions and who are advised by people who do not have the knowledge. So I wanted to go there and see if I can make a little difference at least.
Why do you think it's such a problem in Mexico?
Well, Mexico is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And most of our decision makers did not even get to the places they are in because they have degrees or didn't even go to school. We have deputies who did only the high school, and they don't know. They are just there for the money, and they really do not care about the people they are working for. And we also have a lot of groups, or maybe not a lot of groups, but we also have groups who oppose technology, especially around new technologies that would improve maize. And that is a big issue in Mexico. And we also have almost half of our population are very poor, is very poor. And, it's a big circle.
And so you mentioned the Alliance, Cornell Alliance for Science. Can you tell me a little bit about that program and your involvement with it?
Yes, well, it is a very interesting and exciting program that Dr. Sara Evangia created, viewing that, all the problem I'm talking about, that there is all these cool developments that could alleviate all the problems, or not all the problems, but several problems around agriculture. And she knew that there's a huge need for people who is involved in all this chain, and for people who are going to make the decisions around this, that there's a lack of knowledge around this, and there's a lot of opposition, and the opposition is winning a lot of room around all these topics. So it's more to spread the word about the benefits that biotechnology can bring to agriculture, especially in the developing countries. So I came as a fellow in 2016, and I met another Mexican people there who were interested in the same things that I was. And now my involvement in that way is that we came back to Mexico and we formed like our little Alliance for Science in Mexico. That's not our name. Our name in English would be Mexican Scientists Allied for Knowledge in Agriculture. So we try in our time, because we are also busy people, we do this as volunteers, and so we try to get involved in as much events as we can to talk about agriculture and to talk about genetic modification in crops, and to talk about maybe just about DNA, or just about the environment, or global warming, and how can all these technologies can work, and we get involved in debates And also we are trying to become like a reference. Like, for example, if you are a journalist and you want somebody or somebody who is really experienced in one topic to come to me or to us, and we can connect you with people who are experts in the fields you're looking for around agriculture. And maybe you can have a good sources of information instead of just going to people who maybe do not know a lot of about the topic. So that's what we are trying to do in Mexico.
Wow, what a concept, asking agricultural scientists about agriculture. It's a global problem, I think. It seems like everybody get asked except the people that know agricultural science and farmers, you know, and so it's a common problem in the United States as well. And so I want to open it back up to Nasib, who's sitting alongside Marlene here, because you also were associated with the Alliance for Science as a fellow. And so tell me about your experience and what is it that we're missing in science education, and how can we do a better job of basing our decisions on objective facts instead of fear and misinformation?
Oh, thank you, Alison. I was one of the 2015 fellows with the Cornell Alliance for Science, and it's been one of the most enriching experience in my career as an agricultural communications person. And part of my time as a fellow and my post-life as someone who had to put to good use of the skills acquired in communicating science in a way that benefits the end user, and in this case me, who talks to farmers and, you know, interacts with the public oftentimes, is that facts alone don't matter when it comes to topics like biotech that are very controversial. There's been a lot of fear and misinformation that has been created. And the most important thing is to always, you know, find a common ground with those who are opposed. Because I've realized that those who are opposed to GMOs actually seem to care about the same issues that we who are, you know, pro-science, pro-solution care about. No one wants a starving population unless someone is a psychopath. But I think we define what we think is the best way to address the problem. And I feel like programs like the Cornell Alliance for Science are trying to, you know, create that space for, you know, these voices that seem to, you know, differ on how to solve, you know, problems like hunger, malnutrition, and, you know, other, you know, big challenges, to always look for like that common ground that we all want a more food secure world. How can we use the best tools of science available to address that? So to me, that has been a very good achievement, learning how to sit on a table with people who you differ with and forget about you being pro-GMO, anti-GMO, and, you know, look at, you know, the commonalities you have and taking the conversation around that.
I'd like to put a couple of questions that I often get in audiences from America, to see what your perspective is in answering these questions. So one question I often get is that we produce enough food now to feed everybody on Earth, and it's really just a distribution problem, and that we don't need to produce more food, or we don't need biotech solutions because we already produce enough food. How do you respond to that? I'll start with you, Marlene.
Well, yeah, I also get that a lot. But I think I have gotten that a lot from the people who have easy lives and who can just go to the supermarket, or and even they can choose to which supermarket go, to the cheap one or to the more expensive one. They can really choose. They have a lot of choices. Instead of, they really don't know that. I think that they don't even know how hard it is for the people who produce our food to produce it. And regarding my country, like many, I already said that most, almost half of our population are poor, and I really don't have the number, but a lot of these people are subsistence farmers, and who struggle a lot to produce the food they are going to have all year. And in Mexico, what they produce the most, these subsistence farmers, is maize and beans. And if they lose their crops, they will not have anything to eat. So here, yeah, maybe we, as people who live in the city and who can just go to the supermarket and buy your food, we can say, yeah, I have to be conscious about the food waste, which is also a problem. I'm aware of that, and me myself, I try to eat everything of what I have in my fridge, and I try not to waste anything because I'm conscious about that. But these people also have to know that we need to provide the tools to the people who produce our food, because many of them, at least in my country, depend on the food they produce to survive. And this is not a problem of distribution. This is a problem of, you know, pests, and it didn't rain, so they will not produce anything. So these people do not have the problem of food waste. They have another problem, and people like us who have a say in the conversation, saying that the problem is not implementing or deploying these technologies, but is food waste. Well, they might be right in some amount, but they do not have the other part of the picture in their heads, and they need to understand this. So, yeah.
And what about the Ugandan perspective? Either of you want to touch on that? Emma.
Thank you. Now, like Malina said, you guys are well endowed. You have it all. Okay, so that's why you can afford to say, okay, too much, too little. You know, you can afford to do so much or to say anything. But there's someone out there in these developing countries who actually, an example. I'm not saying his mom, but he gave us a good example. His mom she stays in the city, but all she knows in her life, it's matoke. And this matoke is just, you said it was matoke and then no sauce. So then you can't start saying, so with all the supermarkets around, that is what she had, okay? And then for you, because in the Western part or in the developed world, everyone will be like, okay, I can do this, like Malina said. Now, here in Uganda, we even go ahead that all children, just like actually most children of our time, or our children, or even maybe my time, us, we know where food comes from, but children born by us and by other people of this generation don't know where food comes from. They know all food comes from the supermarket, so I can either go to Whole Foods or whatever. So for us in this other in our world, it's we don't really have the Whole Foods, but we have different supermarkets and everything. But other people can actually go to their gardens. People can't even afford to go to the supermarket. So if I have this little tiny garden that can give me some vegetable, that can give me some matoke, that can give me, I'm okay. I don't even have to go to the supermarket.
Right, so you're saying those subsistence farmers are providing all the food for their own family. They don't have the resources to go to the supermarket, and so either they produce the food or there is no food for that
Yes.
particular family. Yeah. And so one of the criticisms I've heard as it relates to the matoke is that the reason that there's banana wilt disease is because of monoculture. How do you respond to that?
I don't really know actually how banana bacterial wilt came, but it's I don't think so because we have different in Uganda we don't actually do monoculture like you in the States whereby you just find someone is a corn or soy farmer only. We do all these things. It may not be as integrated as me as I do on my farm, but
with your worm poo.
But they do it. It's rare. It's actually the monoculture is just coming up now. But a long time ago, like in my culture, someone needed to have a chicken or two or three. Someone needed to have a goat. Someone needed to have matoke. Someone needed to have coffee. It was like a prerequisite for this person in the central region of Uganda to have all these things. Why? The chicken will give you eggs, that's protein. The goat will still give you meat. And the matoke is a staple food, but coffee is a cash crop. So it was rare. The monoculture is coming from the Western world. So people, we like copying so much, so many things. But the beauty is that we don't even have that land to do all this monoculture.
Mm-hmm.
But Nasib can elaborate.
No, I would like to go back to the issue of whether, you know, we are producing more and the problem is not that there's not
distribution.
Yeah, the problem being a distribution thing. You know, there's some nuances to that question. If you are here in the United States, I feel like, okay, you guys maybe have enough and the problem could be that the distribution channels need to be fixed and, you know, the food gets to everyone. I don't think it applies to the developing world to look at it that way. I agree that food waste is part of the problem. But again, another way of looking at it, when you say we need to fix the distribution, there's no easy answer to that. And it's such a complex thing to do. And also, I'm wondering if you're saying we need to distribute. Are you saying, okay, let's see how we take this food down to the developing world, and how is that gonna, you know, help to address, you know, the long term, you know, issues of people being with food. So I would rather, you know, all tools that can help as we fix distribution, we can also, you know, use and embrace tools like biotech to help address some of these problems as we also fix other
right
issues.
So kind of it's a yes and solution. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a choose one of the following, and I think that kind of dichotomous framing where it's, you know, either this or that is just not how agriculture works. It's always looking at, you know, what you can do to address the problems in an integrated mm-hmm. way, as we've discussed.
Yes.
So,
I would only like to add that, yeah, maybe that is today. Like, we produce enough food today to feed the people that are here today. But in they have said that in 2050 we're going to be 9 billion people in the world. So now we have to produce more with the same amount of land, maybe. So it's worth to try. It's worth to try every tool in the box, like we were saying, to produce more with less in order to be able also to feed the growing population for the coming years. So it's not cool to say we are okay this way, and let's just stay like that.
Mm-hmm. So I feel very privileged to have you three in my office, to be honest. And I think it's such a special thing to have the views of scientists in the developing world. And often that voice is not part of our global discussion around food and agriculture. And so I like to finish up by turning the program over to you. And are there any final comments that you would like to say whilst you're sitting here in my office in Davis on behalf of the countries that you're coming from?
Let's keep in mind whenever we're making these decisions, whatever we decide to go for in terms of decision making, let's think about the developing world, because for some reason we follow what you guys do. So if you say, for example, if either politicians or laws or different things, whatever is said, like an example right now, the big issue is the GM or anti-GM, all that. So if we say no GMOs or no using these technologies, but then they might not be good for you, but they might be good for a certain developing country. An example, Uganda, when it comes to banana bacterial wilt. An example is when it comes to banana bacterial wilt, coffee, cassava, and all that. So we have to keep that in mind when we are deciding on whatever we are going to spread, saying that this is the best for the world.
Well, I would just like to say, either if you are on one side or the other, that it's very important to keep your mind open, to keep your mind open to new things, to new ideas, or at least open up to listen the other people, not just like the people who are always with you and you're all only there in your echo chamber. This is very important to change minds, or to arrive to an agreement, or to produce, to construct. It's always very important to keep your mind open, and in this case it's keep your mind open about science and about technology, because we are here today like using things that were developed by through science and through technology, and maybe many years before people would not have accepted it, but seeing that it brought benefit, it's this is why we are using it here. And also it's you know that it comes with a little risks. For example, if I pour water on this microphone right now, we might have an accident here. But we can know these risks, but we can also learn to manage them. So just think about that.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're not pouring water on the microphone, because that would upset me. And we'll finish up with you, Nasib.
Yes, my final thoughts, and I think I've said this previously, and also Dr. Sarah Ivan just said this during one of the panel discussions, that the conversations around food and farming, especially in the devolved world, have ripple effects in how policies around food and farming in the developed world, in the developing world, are shaped. So, as someone may have the luxury here to be opposed to GMOs and being vocal about that, inadvertently, it's gonna affect someone who might need these technologies in the developing world. So we need to reflect more on how we oppose some of these technologies in science. And at the end of the day, if I were to hypothetically create two people in this world, and where every one of us can choose to fall, we can have those who would always find a problem with new technologies and what they can do, and then we can have those who are pro solution. So the choice is for one to make, whether you want to belong to a world which is always, you know, criticizing and, you know, finding problems with solutions, or you want to be part of the group which is embracing of solutions and also letting people choose and see what works for them. So that's, you know, my final remark. Choose the world you want to belong to.
Uh-huh.
Do you want a world of being always whining and complaining, or a world where you're pro solution on whatever issue? Think about that, and that's it.
Spoken like a true agricultural scientist, trying to find solutions to farmers' problems, and I think that's kind of where we have that that in common, and something we all work towards. So thank you, the three of you, for spending some time chatting to me here, and I look forward to hearing your comments at the conference tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you too.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.